Hello and welcome to Beyond the Filter, a podcast about censorship. My name's Brandy.
And my name's Jeremy. In this episode, we're speaking with Dr. Craig Harper, a researcher from Nottingham Trent University, who's going to be talking to us about fantasy sexual materials and how they may or may not relate to real sexual offending. So thank you very much for joining us, Craig.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you, Craig. Could you please start by explaining the nature of the research you're currently conducting?
Sure. So we've been looking at essentially the role of various different forms of sexual material, whether they be kind of cartoons or AI-generated material or sex dolls, things that essentially don't depict a real person in the material, and looking specifically at how they might be associated or not associated with risks for sexual abuse or sexual offending. Really, it comes from a tendency in some of our research to think about what are the risks and what are not the risks, and kind of really trying to address a lack of data in a lot of public policy discussions.
What sort of data predated your own, and what did it indicate?
In terms of data that's predated ours, there's not an awful lot at all, to be honest. A lot of the discussions that we've been having, so I do this work with a colleague of mine, Dr. Rebecca Leasley at NTU. A lot of the stuff that we've been doing is essentially based on a lack of evidence about various policy proposals that have been put forward by various different legislators. Specifically, we started looking at the topic of sex dolls because we saw a lot of jurisdictions starting to ban different doll types, particularly childlike sex dolls, which intuitively people may think that's a good thing. But when you think about the grounds under which those bans were introduced, it's about risk and about harm reduction. And actually, there's a subset of people within the community who may potentially benefit from some of these sexual outlets where they don't have alternatives. And really our question that we started with was what is the evidence behind some of these harm reduction proposals and whether or not we could provide some evidence in relation to them. A lot of the policy proposals were based on moral arguments about what may and may not be risk enhancing without really considering how these materials could be used productively or in the service of prevention, I guess. And that's where we really started.
So it's really interesting that you say that there wasn't a lot of research prior to yours, because the way that policy debates go, it sounds as if the science is more settled than it actually is, because you often hear from policymakers, from child safety groups and so on, that, you know, there is a direct correlation between fantasy materials and offending. So it sounds like that's not actually demonstrated by the data that you have. So what do you attribute it to that policymakers kind of act on the assumption that there is already a demonstrated link?
I think a lot of it comes from logical inference, I guess. I think a lot of people start from the assumption that if someone's engaging in a particular behavior that looks risky, then it is risky. And that's not necessarily the case. Obviously, for some people it will be, but for others it won't. And I guess my job, our job as researchers, is to understand the conditions under which use of various different materials, whether they be AI-generated materials or sex dolls, for example, under what conditions they are risky and under what conditions they're maybe not risky, or maybe where they could be used in the service, like I say, of prevention rather than in the service of offending, I guess. And that's really our role as researchers, to understand and to unpick where there is risk, where there isn't risk, and then to work with policymakers to craft evidence-informed policies. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be calling for blanket decriminalization or blanket availability of different sexual materials, but maybe there are conditions under which things could be used in restricted ways or regulated ways where they don't cause harm.
Well, one of the things that I've been working on is a report about countries around the world that do criminalize these materials, including the UK, and suggesting that maybe criminalization isn't always the way to prevent the spread of offensive content throughout society. Maybe we can look beyond the criminal law to think more about like warning labels, classifications, limited availability, so that particularly when we're talking about on the online space, you don't want it to be a wash in material that could offend a lot of people. But at the same time, you don't necessarily want to be arresting people over cartoons. And one of the other things that my research points to, which we'll be publishing in the next month or so, is that in the UK specifically, there's actually been a diversion of enforcement resources away from prosecuting child sex abuse material, images like photos and videos, towards prosecuting fantasy and fictional content. And it's actually quite striking. There's been a 40% of all image-based prosecutions now are over fictional or fantasy content. So I assume you weren't aware of that because I only just got that information from a Freedom of Information request. But it does show that we're actually leeching away some of those resources that used to be spent entirely on real images and, real photos and videos towards this fantasy content. And so do you feel that your research could help to inform debates over resource allocation in that sense?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, so I wasn't aware of that data. I'd be really interested to look at it and understand whether or not that is a rediversion, I guess, of resource or whether they are additional offences. So has there been a kind of a corresponding drop in the number of child sexual abuse material investigations in comparison to some of those fantasy investigations? That would be an interesting kind of comparison, I guess. But yeah, I think it would be nice to see some evidence within some of these social debates that we're seeing. So I think in a lot of social policy, particularly around sexual offending, we have an emphasis on quite intuitive common sense. And I use common sense in kind of the colloquial kind of way, in terms of things that we think are some of the things that we think are logical, things that we think are common sense. I think we take that approach to sexual crime prevention. And I think what that does a lot of the time is it diverts attention away from what the evidence says about what is effective and what isn't effective. And in some ways we do drive people underground into kind of the darker areas of the internet if we start criminalizing things. Equally, it may be, and this is a hypothesis that we haven't tested, it may be that criminalization does stop some people from engaging with certain materials. But those people are unlikely to be the ones, I think, that would be the ones that would be posing a risk in the first place, because they are averse to engaging in risky behaviours. Yeah, I guess there's different ways of thinking about the role and the function of criminalization.
Well, that's interesting what you just mentioned. But just before we get back onto that, I will give you a little preview of the data that I mentioned earlier. Yes, we can see that there's been a drop in the number of real CSAM offences being prosecuted. So it isn't just adding on additional virtual offences. It is a pretty significant drop from about 4,000 odd per year to about 2,000 odd per year on average over the last 15 years. So anyway, you're going to be able to read that data soon along with everyone else when we release it within the next month or so. But coming back to what you just mentioned, it sounds like there is no universal relationship between taboo sexual fantasies and real world offending. But you've said for the kind of people who may seek out fictional material, they may be less likely in general to have the character of an offender. Is that what you were saying?
No, that's not what I meant. So what I meant was when you criminalize something, the people that are generally more pro-social, the ones that are less likely to offend in the first place, they're the ones that you're less likely to see accessing those materials. So actually, you don't change risk, I guess. And this is a hypothesis. This isn't something that is demonstrated in the data that we've got, because we haven't collected this data. But I would assume that when you criminalize something, you don't change base levels of risk within society, because the people that were accessing the things that were legal to begin with, that are now not legal, that you've banned, are unlikely to be the ones that are going to be engaging in offending behaviour anyway, whereas the ones that were risky to begin with are more likely to habitually engage with those kind of fictional materials, even when they become criminal, I guess. So that's what I meant in terms of the distinction between criminalisation and the link between criminalisation and base levels of risk. In terms of the association between use of fictional sexual materials and risk of sexual offending, our research is converging around the view that there's no association at all. So we've got multiple data sets now looking at fictional sexual materials generally, so including things like AI stories that are fictional, cartoons like you've mentioned. And then we've got specific samples of people who are owning sex dolls, both adult-like and child-like sex dolls. And essentially those data sets, I think there's four or five of them now, are all suggesting that there's no functional link between the use or the frequency of use of those materials and risk. So no association in either direction. So we're not making the assumption, and this is, I'm not making the argument, sorry, and this is an assumption that people make about some of our data sometimes, that fictional sexual material use is preventative. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that it doesn't necessarily increase risk. which is what the grounds for a lot of the criminalization calls are based around, I guess. So our data, like I say, from multiple different sources now, multiple different contexts and multiple different places that we've collected these data, seem to be suggesting to us that there's no functional link between the use of FSM, fictional sexual material, and risk. But this is all cross-sectional data, and this is something that is a limitation, I guess, of some of our work. And it's quite difficult to do this kind of work in a definitive way. Like, you can't ethically give a group of people who may be perceived as being at risk of sexual offending, you can't give them materials and just wait to see what happens to see whether or not they engage in sexual offending, because that wouldn't be ethical. You'd be potentially putting people at risk if the material did increase the likelihood of harm. So we have to do these observational studies to look at how often people are using different materials, and then correlate that with how they judge offence-related scenarios, how they report their own sexual behaviour, how they talk about different potential victim groups. But like I say, what we're seeing in a lot of our data sets is no functional link. But actually, when you think about sexual satisfaction and sexual frustration, when you increase sexual satisfaction, you see risk levels reduce. And I think this is the really kind of interesting part of a lot of our data, and it's not about the frequency with which someone is using these materials, but more about maybe the function of that material use within that person's sex life. So if that use is leading to a lot of sexual satisfaction or increasing someone's sexual satisfaction, particularly in groups where they can't achieve sexual satisfaction in legal ways, I'm thinking particularly in terms of people who are attracted to children potentially, then what we're seeing is a reduction in, again, self-reported risk. And that's a big caveat in a lot of this work. It's all self-report measures. But what we are seeing is consistent evidence across different data sets of that kind of trend.
What methodologies are you adopting in your research, and what are their shortcomings?
So like I just mentioned, we've got a lot of data sets at the moment, but they are self-report surveys. So we're using a lot of kind of large-scale surveys with various people in different communities. We've got currently under review, we've got a paper that is looking at a representative sample of the UK. So that's around 2,000 people, looking at kind of generally fictional sexual material use with a focus on AI. We've also got some quite specific samples of people who are in the community attracted to children who haven't offended. They're kind of within the community living with those attractions to children. So we've looked at how they kind of cope, I guess, with their sexual attractions, how they use sexuality, how they're engaging with fictional sexual materials. We've also looked at different groups who own sex dolls. So there are various forums online for people who own sex dolls. We've also looked at data from people who are buying sex dolls as well. So there's lots of different samples, but the methodology that we're using is self-report surveys. And obviously the big caveat and the limitation of that is that self-report data can be subject to social desirability biases, and that if somebody believes that you are trying to paint a particular picture, they can tell you the opposite if that's what they want to paint. I guess we do have some counterbalances or counter kind of arguments to that, in that the relationships that we see within our data sets in terms of associations between other factors and risk, so things like offence-supportive cognition, so these kind of deviant sexual thoughts or pro-criminal attitudes, they are associated with an increase in self-reported risk. So we aren't necessarily seeing blanket across the board a rejection of offending behaviour. We're seeing kind of rates that we would expect in general community samples. But yeah, the big caveat is that a lot of this is self-report is correlational as well. So we are looking essentially at what does someone score on a measure of FSM use, fictional sexual material use, and how do they also score on essentially a proxy for offending behavior, and then doing a correlation to look at that. So there are kind of issues around the kind of inferences that we can make about that. But yeah, it comes down to what's the plausible inference. So thinking about the result I mentioned earlier about sexual satisfaction. So it's not plausible to us necessarily that sexual satisfaction is a result of offending when someone is also experiencing lots of shame associated with their sexual attraction patterns. Whereas it is much more plausible that having a sexual outlet that is causing you to have sexual satisfaction is then associated with a reduction in a reported likelihood of offending. So this offending outcome that we're looking at in a lot of the studies is a likelihood of offending. So would you do this in these circumstances? And it makes sense to us that the sexual satisfaction comes as a predictor of that. Obviously, there's a correlation the other way that we could look at, but it then becomes about plausibility of what's that, what does that relationship look like?
So you've kind of touched on this already, but since not everyone who's listening may have a scientific background, can you just step us through a bit more specifically what would be the difference between correlation versus causation? So how do you differentiate between correlation and causation in this type of research?
So correlation is essentially, is there a relationship? So as you increase one thing, what happens to something else in terms of a crude score? Now, it could be that as you increase one thing, the other score goes up, but it could equally be that as the other score goes up, so does the first variable that you're measuring. So it could be in the example that I just gave. So in our data set, we're seeing that as sexual satisfaction goes up, the reported likelihood of engaging in criminal behavior in terms of sexual offending is lower. It could be that people who are less likely to engage or to report being likely to engage in offending behavior are more sexually, that's what's causing them to be more sexually satisfied. But plausibly, that doesn't necessarily make sense. If you wanted to make that argument, though, in terms of causality, what you would need to do is to take one big group, which was roughly the same in terms of their levels of sexual satisfaction. And then you would have to artificially induce a degree of higher sexual satisfaction in about half of them, and then see what happens to those two groups in terms of their self-reported likelihood of offending. And like I said earlier, it's from an ethical perspective, we can't do that in this area. We ethically would not be able to, and we wouldn't want to, take a group, give half of that group fictional sexual materials, and essentially wait to see what happens to risk. We wouldn't want to do that because we wouldn't want to put people at risk if there is an association or if there is an escalation of risk attributable to that FSM, which is why we're limited to these more, what's referred to as a cross-sectional study, where you're essentially looking at those correlations, those associations between different scores.
Do factors like loneliness, mental health, or prior trauma mediate how someone engages with these materials?
Potentially, yes. So particularly in some of the sex doll work that we've conducted, what we've found is that people who own sex dolls, particularly adult-like sex dolls, tend to have a history of poor quality relationships. We're thinking about male doll owners with female appearing dolls, tend to have a history of poor quality relationships, a history of relationship breakdown, so whether that be separation or divorce. And when we ask them about the function of their doll in their life, they talk about obviously the sexual functions in terms of this doll being their perfect partner. They're able to construct the perfect partner physically, but they also talk about the companionship that they get from the doll. And I think this is probably going to be something that is much more salient as the dolls become much more tech enabled. And when you think about sex dolls emerging or kind of transforming now into sex robots, having the AI incorporated into them, I think that's going to be a much stronger, I guess, motivation for some people to engage with what we currently call sex dolls and sex robots, what will probably start to become social dolls, social robots with a sexual function. So yeah, I think there's definitely an attachment or a loneliness, a mental health kind of function to a lot of these materials, particularly the more immersive ones.
I just leading on for that, you just sparked my curiosity. Are you looking into how the AI girlfriend trend that's coming up?
We haven't so far, but as with anything in this space, as the technology evolves, so do our research ideas. So it's something that we are definitely interested in looking at, particularly when we think about kind of generative AI and the way that the various groups are talking about generative AI and how it might or might not be associated with risk or how it might be functionally associated with reductions in risk. It's certainly something that we're interested in looking at.
So speaking of mental health, a lot of the work that you're doing would be applied in a clinical setting, right? So from a clinical standpoint, how should therapists or support services respond when clients disclose the use of this sexual fantasy material?
This is a really difficult one because obviously at the moment, a lot of these materials are criminalized and clinicians are duty bound in many jurisdictions to report when things like this are disclosed. So if someone is disclosing criminal behavior, there may be, depending on the jurisdiction, maybe a mandated requirement to report that. So in the immediate kind of, in the immediate future, it's about thinking through, do they have to make that report? Is there a requirement to make that report? If there isn't a requirement to make that report in law, then exploring with the client, what's the function of that material use? How are they using that material? How often are they using that material? What role does that material play in their sex life? Is it increasing things like sexual preoccupation, for example, thinking about things that may be indicative of what might be referred to as problematic sexual arousal, Are people engaging in compulsive sexual behaviors? Are they using it for coping mechanisms? Or is it part of a healthier kind of pattern of sexual expression? Is it a way for them to engage in sexual activity that they otherwise wouldn't be able to? Are they thinking about what might be referred to as deviant sexual thoughts less or more as a result of their engagement with fictional sexual materials? I think in time, one thing that is probably going to be much more of a feature of some of our work is how do professional groups actually embed some of these materials within their practice, whether that's ethical or not to do. Obviously, thinking about the fact that some things are prohibited by law, would there be potential exclusions to the law for therapeutic use, potentially, if we're able to demonstrate links between sexual satisfaction and reductions in risk, for example. Obviously, this is in the future. This is not something that we're calling for right now and not something that we have the data to call for right now. But I think it's something that if the data do continue to show the same story, which is what we are seeing in a lot of our data sets, it's something that, that legislators, that clinicians, that professional colleges may start to think about, obviously with the appropriate risk assessments in place. But yeah, I think there's definitely the potential for discussions around the clinical use of some limited fictional sexual materials in certain circumstances.
Well, the research that I'm doing that I mentioned earlier is about how these materials are treated in different jurisdictions around the world, covering 10 countries in the first edition of the report. And so that may be useful, I guess, for clinicians in other countries who may not be bound by some of the same restrictions as in the UK. They may have a bit more latitude to investigate, you know, talking about these outlets with their clients.
Are there treatment or intervention methods that integrate or restrict fantasy outlets?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I think the fact that these materials, there is a lot of uncertainty among people who are using them, but also among treatment providers about what is and what isn't legal, what isn't allowable. For example, we've recently finished doing some data collection looking at law enforcement views, for example, on the topic of sex dolls. And actually, a lot of the people that we were talking to who were involved in law enforcement were not aware of what the laws were around sex doll ownership, for example, particularly in relation to childlike sex dolls. So if law enforcement aren't sure, clinicians also probably aren't sure. So I think a lot of the lack of kind of discussion at the moment, in particularly in clinical settings, is due to a lack of security, I guess, a lot of defensive decision making in medical psychological therapy. If we talk to sex therapists, they feel like they're a little bit more open to these kinds of issues. But again, when you start talking about paraphilic themes, so attraction to children, as to or attraction patterns that involve violence or coercion, it feels much more uncomfortable in that context. So again, there's maybe more resistance or more reluctance to have those discussions rather than someone who is potentially experiencing erectile dysfunction, and maybe they might feel more comfortable practicing having sex with a doll or with the AI girlfriend like you discussed, Brandy. It may be that these kinds of clinical presentations are much more comfortable to work with, but I guess these are entry points into these discussions. These are ways that we can open up the discussion and think about, okay, well, if there are some circumstances under which dolls or fictional sexual materials are permissible or could be useful, what are the other potential areas? Are there other potential areas where it would be permissible, ethical, legal, useful to think about some of these materials being used in therapeutic settings?
I think maybe a lot of the difference is how people feel about the user of the outlet. Another example of one that might be seen as more permissible was I was speaking to someone who worked with people who have developmental disabilities. And often, you know, they have a childlike mentality, like a five-year-old, for example, even though they may be bodily a teenager or adult. This person told me that they would actually find it useful to have a sex doll available for use of their client so that the client doesn't, you know, without full awareness of what they're doing, sexually assault a caseworker or someone who's a support worker, because they just would act on their instincts sometime and do these sexually harmful things. without having a full capacity to understand what they're doing. And this person was telling me that having a sex doll might actually provide a useful outlet for their clients so that they'd be less likely to engage in these harmful behaviors.
Yeah, and I think there will be some therapists that are more open to having those discussions even now without the data. And I think, again, this is something that is it's quite difficult to talk about as a researcher because the data just isn't there at the moment. So we're talking about hypotheticals in terms of what could or couldn't be permissible. And I think there are some people who are potentially much more liberal, much more open about the potential for alternative therapies. And we really need to be careful about the extent to which we're running before we can walk with some of these things. So it's great that you're talking to people who are open to these kind of discussions. I would be hesitant to encourage therapists at the moment to use these kind of materials. I think there may be a role for some limited use of some materials in certain circumstances, but as the data currently stand, we don't know what those circumstances are and we don't know who those clients are. So I think it's far too premature to be making definitive recommendations at the moment, but I think it's good that those conversations are starting to be had because it opens up possibilities for the research so that we can get those data to actually have that evidence-informed discussion.
Now, given how important this is to current debates about regulating AI and, the AI girlfriends that Brandy was talking about, dolls and so on, it seems that research is not being prioritized to the level that it should be. Is that a fair assumption? Is it difficult to get funding for this sort of work?
I mean, I think if you ask any researcher, is your area being funded enough, they're probably going to say no. But I think, it's very difficult to get funding or to access funding in this area. We're limited, I guess, to thinking about stakeholder groups potentially to fund this. So kind of tech groups maybe, or organizations that are particularly forthright, I guess, about civil and online liberty. And traditional funders are a little bit more hesitant a lot of the time to think about this, particularly those who maybe are looking for safer research. I think there is a hesitancy to think about funding this. Because also, what if the data do come out and suggest that, I mean, in either direction, I guess, if the data come out and suggest that FSM use is associated with risk, then potentially, depending on the methodology that someone's used, a funder might be seen as being complicit in supporting stuff in that area, supporting potential escalation of behavior. Equally, if the data come out and suggest that FSM use is associated with lower levels of risk, then from a societal perspective, that's not a popular position to be in, even with the data. So a funder potentially doesn't want to be associated with that kind of conclusion. And I guess there's those kinds of considerations that are potentially implicit in some of the decision-making processes. But like I say, I think if you ask any researcher whether their research is funded enough, most people are going to say no, because we want more research funding for our areas. But I do think that there are some areas that are potentially more problematic in terms of accessing funds or resources than others.
So in your current findings, are there many key differences between different groups? For example, adults interested in adults versus pedophiles and other paraphilias?
Broadly, no. Do you mean in terms of the association between fictional sexual material use and risk or self-reported propensities for offending? The conclusion tends to hold consistently across different groups and across different forms of FSM. I guess one key difference that we found in the people who have childlike sex dolls was that those who owned a sex doll were less preoccupied, less sexually preoccupied than people who were attracted to children who didn't own a childlike sex doll. And again, this goes back to the point that I was raising earlier in terms of, yes, these are correlational data, but it makes no sense that the relationship or the causal relationship would be the other way around, right? Because there's no plausible explanation that would provide an explanation for why less preoccupied people, less sexually preoccupied people, would be going out of their way to spend potentially thousands of dollars on a sex doll when more highly preoccupied people aren't doing that. So the correlation makes sense, the theoretical correlation makes sense, and the only plausible to us anyway, the only plausible causal argument that is associated with that correlation is that dolls are reducing sexual preoccupation. Now, I'm happy to have this conversation with statisticians that maybe are able to explain that correlation as potentially being the other way around, but plausibly that correlation doesn't make sense the other way around. But generally, the broad kind of conclusion of no association between risk and FSM use is holding across different.
So A few minutes ago, you were talking about how funders are reluctant to get involved with research that's of a controversial nature. So how has this affected you as a researcher in terms of maybe some backlash that you may have received or some misunderstanding that you might receive around your work? And what effect has that had?
I think we just need to be really careful about how we frame our findings. I think we see it socially, we see it in peer review when we're writing papers and we're getting comments from reviewers and editors. The implicit assumption is that we're supportive of fictional sexual material use. And that's not the case at all. We're coming at this from a very evidence-blind, perspective, in terms of we see these arguments and we always frame our papers around kind of, there are essentially three arguments, right? There's the risk-enhancing argument that FSM use potentially increases risk. There's the risk-reduction argument, which is that FSM reduces risk. And there's the functional argument, which is that FSM use is unrelated to risk, but is potentially associated with things like the alleviation of sexual frustration and the achievement of sexual satisfaction. And that's ultimately where we come from as a research team. So myself and Rebecca, that's where we set our research up. That's how we set our research up. To a certain degree, we don't have a stake in terms of what the data say, in terms of if the data were uniformly saying that FSM use increases risk, then we would be supporting calls to restrict access, because that would be the ethical position to be in. If we're universally seeing that FSM use is associated with decreases in risk, then we would be making that argument as well, in terms of more forcefully maybe talking about the fact that criminalization is counter to the evidence. Whereas what we're finding is that the data are not supportive of either of those two extreme positions, but much more associated with a functional approach, a more nuanced approach. So we need to be thinking about the conditions under which FSM use could be risky and isn't risky, and understanding where those different groups maybe are in society. And I think that's a big misconception about a lot of the work that we do, in that I think because we take quite a, I wouldn't even call it adversarial, it would be a case of a questioning position in terms of the status quo, of people making an intuitive decision almost before they know what the data say about what is and what isn't going to be the result. I think we take a view of, we're going to question that, and we're going to question that status quo and see where the data take us. And I think sometimes the data take us in a place that is uncomfortable to people who have already made up their minds about what the data should say. I think from within academia, within research context, we see skepticism a lot of the time about some of our data, and we're trying to open up some of our research processes to kind of counteract that. Socially, we do see a lot of backlash. So some of our research has been covered in the UK press, for example, where we've been misquoted. We're about kind of talking about the destigmatization, for example, of attractions to children. We've also seen that in academic publications. There was a paper recently about the use of the label MAP, and I'm kind of hesitant to get into that debate publicly, because there doesn't seem to be any value in having that debate socially, because to us, the MAP label is an umbrella term to describe attractions to children. It doesn't have to us any greater function than that in terms of our own work. I know for some people, they talk about using MAP as a destigmatizing approach. For us, it is literally a label to describe sexual attraction patterns. But there's been kind of a backlash about that in the academic literature. There was a review published last year, which heavily and repeatedly misquoted a lot of our work. So we're seeing misquotation across different contexts, whether that be socially, whether that be in academia. And I guess it just means that we need to be really careful about how we frame our results, how we talk about our research, how we frame our data in terms of the limitations. You've seen just in this interview how I'm talking about the caveats of a lot of the data that we have, the fact that it's too premature to be making any firm recommendations, but talking about the fact that we are seeing quite consistent data across different data sets. So to us, it's about being really careful in terms of how we're framing our conclusions and how we're making arguments about our data.
Yeah, I saw that you were able to respond to that paper that you referred to that made the misleading comments about your research. So at least it's not just a one-way conversation. But am I too cynical in thinking that a lot of the backlash is kind of motivated reasoning, in the sense that people already have an aversive reaction towards the idea of people seeking out this content, just partly an instinctive and partly sort of a media led revulsion towards the idea of someone having a sexuality that would attract them towards these materials. And therefore, that guides a lot of their thinking about, you know, what the data must say. And they're not necessarily interested in what the data does say. They're interested in, you know, claiming scientific support for a decision that they've already reached.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happens. And I think my background is in social attitude research. And I think a lot of the decisions that we make, or a lot of the attitudes that we express, are heuristically driven. So they're driven by these kind of impulses, these intuitions that we have about the way the world should be, rather than the way that the world is. I think that a lot of the discussions that we have, particularly around sexual offending, particularly around paedophilia, is driven by these modes of thinking. I think you mentioned about kind of the media whipping up a little bit of hysteria. I'm less convinced by that argument, to be honest. I think the media reflect what's going on in society rather than causing what's going on in society. And I think that people have this intuitive revulsion to what they see as being sexual deviance and what they intuitively think is risky. I think the media reflect that a lot of the time. And I think obviously there are political motivations within the media to advance particular political parties or political candidates who are making certain arguments in much more provocative ways, potentially. But ultimately, I think the media are reflecting the social status quo rather than causing it. That doesn't mean that I think that the argument doesn't stand. I think that, yeah, a lot of the discussions that we have are based around instincts that people have about what is and what isn't risky.
So what are the biggest gaps in the research right now?
So obviously the biggest gap is the causal argument. We don't have any good causal data at the moment about the effects of fictional sexual material use. Now, obviously, there's different ways that we can do that. We can look at people who are just starting to use various forms of fictional sexual material. I guess the advent and the growth of generative AI gives an opportunity for us to do that in terms of people are just starting to adopt it. So naturalistically, we can look at how people are using AI as different tools emerge. I guess that would get around some of the ethical concerns around researchers administering fictional sexual materials, if it's more of an observational study. But that takes time. And quite often, legislators are not willing to wait to form policies or to create laws, particularly when there is such a social environment that is calling for restriction, calling for regulation, because of these kind of fear-related intuitions. And I think that's the biggest gap in our knowledge at the moment. We have, I think, relatively good, relatively consistent data about relationships between fictional sexual material use and risk. But that kind of data is never going to form policy. That's never going to change how people think about the criminalization or the legalization or the regulated use of these kinds of materials. To do that, we really need good causal longitudinal data or intervention type data. But like I say, that takes time, that takes investment, that takes resource, and it takes an openness to think and talk about some of these topics, particularly when the topics are controversial, particularly when we're thinking about things like child sexual abuse prevention, which is why I guess the advent of, or the introduction of generative AI and the growth maybe of kind of virtual reality porn might be a way in to some of that work, if we can think about adult related material first, to establish whether there is any association between using technology and risk. It opens up those conversations at least, but that's the biggest kind of hurdle at the moment. The biggest gap is that we don't have that causal data, that ability to make causal arguments.
If you had unlimited funding or access, what kind of study would you want to run to clarify these issues?
I think it would be what I was just describing in terms of more of those observational studies. I think obviously the gold standard of research is an experimental design. If you really want to get causal relationships, you need an experimental design. And I think, although from a research perspective, that would be the gold standard, I'd be very uncomfortable running that kind of study. I'd be very uncomfortable not knowing the effect of, say, for example, a childlike sex doll, not knowing the effect at baseline and essentially administering that as an intervention, not knowing what's going to happen. Ethically, that doesn't sit right with me. So I think these more observational studies, looking at how people who are just starting to use different types of technology within the community, and then following those people up over time, looking at how that use is associated with changes in sexual thinking, sexual attitudes, sexual behaviors, sexual interest, potentially, and how that maybe links to the engagement in more risky sexual behaviors that may be associated with risk. it's a much more comfortable place to be as a researcher, where you can start to get at some of those causal mechanisms as well. So I think obviously the gold standard would be that intervention study, that experimental study, but sometimes you need to balance gold standard research practices with what your ethical boundaries are and what the potential harm is that you could cause if you get something wrong. And I think for me, for us as a research team, we're always driven by what's the best quality data that we can get within an ethical framework. And I think that kind of observational, long-term, longitudinal approach is probably at the moment the best that we could do.
So without giving us any spoilers that you don't want to, what will be the next publication that comes out from you or the colleagues that you're working with?
So we've currently got some of the data that I've already discussed today, and that is currently under review. So hopefully that will be coming out soon, we hope. We've also got some other data looking at people who own sex dolls who maybe aren't quite as open about their sex doll ownership, so maybe looking away from forum-based recruitment. There are some differences potentially in those. We're currently crunching the numbers on that data set. We've also, like I said, got data, both qualitative and quantitative, looking at professional views as well about, again, sex doll ownership and how different professional groups think about sex dolls in comparison to the public, which is quite interesting. And I think it's something that potentially will start some of these discussions that we've been talking about in terms of openness to considering the use of different forms of fictional sexual material and maybe where some of the hesitancy comes from. A lot of the people that we talk to are talking about the fact that they just don't know what is legal, what is not legal, what is safe, what is not safe. And again, research is the key. We need more data to inform policy and also professional practice in law enforcement and healthcare in different domains. So yeah, we've got various different papers that may be coming out at some point in the next 6 months or so, I'd hope.
I'm really grateful that we do have at least some dedicated researchers like yourself who are willing to dive into these difficult areas. So thank you so much for spending the last hour with us. And do you have any final remarks you'd like to leave with our listeners?
No, I think just whenever you're kind of talking about these kind of topics, think about where your attitudes are coming from. Think about whether you're making an intuitive decision, whether you're making an intuitive statement, or whether you're maybe considering some of the evidence, considering an alternative viewpoint. I think whenever you're thinking about sexual crime prevention, try as much as possible to take a breath and think about where your attitudes are coming from. And I think if people can do that, we might have collectively, socially, a much more constructive discussion about how to prevent sexual harm.
Such a wonderful note to end on. So thank you very much again, Craig. Any final words, Brandy?
I just want to say thank you for such a wonderful interview, Craig. That was worth being up at 3 a.m. for.
So yeah, thanks once again, Craig, and thanks to our listeners as well. And you can all tune in again next month for another episode of Beyond the Filter. Thanks again, Craig, and bye-bye for now.
Thank you.